I'm your host, Maya Fisher-French, and welcome to the My Money, My Lifestyle podcast, where we discuss all things money because whether or not we like it, money matters. So this is my first podcast of 2024, and I want to wish all my listeners a very happy new year. Now, over the December break, I was busy. I was reading this book, Why Banks Fail by David Buckham, which I loved and spent a lot of time with my highlighter underlining some excellent observations by David, who I think I can sum up as an expert in the global banking system. So he's founder and CEO of Monocle Solutions, a management consulting firm to banks and insurers. And he's written numerous books about the crisis facing the global financial industry. So this is actually the third book that I've read by David. The first was The End of Money. And The End of Money, he starts this conversation about the great erosion of trust in banking. He refers to the global financial crisis of 2008, China's banking and credit woes, the rise of cryptocurrency and its inherent flaws. And then in his second book, he wrote about Age of Menace. And there was very interesting. He raised the issue of unfettered capitalism, inequality, and he raised important questions actually about the leaders of the tech industry. But now let's get back to his latest book, In Why Banks Fail. So here David picks up on the theme of the erosion of trust in the banking system. And he actually raises the point that banks are a lot more risky than we realize. So he writes that given banking's fundamental role in society, it is one of the great meta-narratives of our world that banking is safe, stable and secure. But this is an illusion. And on that note, welcome, David.
Thank you, Maya, so much for having me on your show. It's a great opportunity for me to spread the message that I'm trying to get across to people. And it's a great privilege to be invited by you to be present on the show. Thank you so much.
Well, I think, David, for me, your books, and I really, really recommend them. If you, you know, the thinnest one of them is Why Banks Fail. So you may want to start with that. But all of them were really very insightful. And for me, pulled together so many of these themes that, you know, we kind of are thinking and worrying about, but we haven't had them all put together for us to understand really what this crisis is about. And in Why Banks Fail, you really go through the history of banking and you relate the history of the very first bank, the Medici Bank, 1397, and how its collapse all those centuries ago can be compared to the banking crisis we face today. And you explain how every bank failure, and they happen all the time, is ultimately a result of a lack of trust, because there is, and you write, an inevitability of failure once the public trust is lost. So why is trust so important? Or perhaps said differently, what happens when we lose trust?
Maya, it's a really interesting question that you've asked, because there are actually two kinds of trust. The one kind of trust is inherent within us as a society. So we have something which I would call mass cognitive dissonance, which is that we as people hold two contradictory ideas in our heads at the same time as it pertains to banks. We like to say in general that we don't trust the banks. We like to say that the banks are fleecing us or are taking our money or not to be trusted. But at the same time, we trust them all the time with our money. We put our money in the banks. We transact every day with banks. We take money out of the ATMs. We know that the banks are going to balance our bank accounts. I've never really had people coming to me and saying that the bank stole money from me. It's actually quite rare. And yet we like to not trust the banks in our speech. That's a different kind of lack of trust to when people actually lose trust in banks, which can happen quite suddenly with a particular bank. Usually it's kicked off by a particular reputational event. The most easy one to refer to now would be Credit Suisse, when it was discovered that the CEO and the bank had been spying on each other. And that was the end of a long list of moments of distrust. Then what people do is they pull their deposits from that bank in fear that their deposits are not safe. And because banking is inherently lending money long, and borrowing short, so that you constantly, as a bank, have to replenish your stores. Once people pull their deposits, then the bank will fail instantly in a kind of sudden death moment. I like to say that the idea that banking is safe is kind of an Easter Bunny narrative. It's one of the great fables that we like to believe. We all still believe in the Easter Bunny as it pertains to banking, until we don't.
What's interesting for me there, David, is it's actually about it only works if we trust. That's it. If we don't trust, it doesn't work. So I suppose that the trust in the Easter Bunny is, we all just have to agree. And I think that is sort of this concept of the fact that we put societies together, the fact that we put banking systems together, is that we've all kind of agreed to the system. And that is the crux of it. It's a bank. And I think you allude to so many of the bank failures over time, and all of them, often it wasn't that they didn't have the capitalization. It was literally that you pull the deposits. They can't meet those deposits, simply because it's important for people to understand, you know, if you put 1,000 rand with the bank, it's lent out several times. It's not, you know, that there's a ratio to which the banks will lend that money out. So they can't necessarily give you your 1,000 rand back. Well, they can't give every single depositor their 1,000 rand back on the same day. Otherwise, they can't generate the interest that they need to from the lending activities. So there is this thing that I trust that you will give me my money when I need it. If I start to not believe that, and I want to draw my money, and so does everybody else, you just shut the bank down, whether or not it's true.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Truman Show. I don't know if you remember that movie, The Truman Show, where he lives in a fake world. And everything's fine until he doesn't believe it. And then he kind of pierces the veil. And banking is the same in that it's inherently a flawed business model. The amount of optionality that is given to customers, such as you and me, to pull out our deposits through our current accounts. If any bank experienced all depositors, or even half of the depositors, pulling their deposits out, or even a quarter on a single day, which happened to Silicon Valley Bank or First Republic Bank, and back in the day happened to Sambo Bank in South Africa, or as happened to Credit Suisse, that will bring a bank to its knees instantaneously. Whereas regulators and the general public are told that the problem is one of capital, actually, that's not true. The problem of capital, banks very, very rarely will make such a big loss that they go out of business. Usually they have enough retained earnings and equity to cover that loss. I can almost not think of a single example where a bank has failed because of losses. Deutsche Bank, for example, made sustained annual losses in the billions of euros for years on end, and is still in existence today. Whereas if all of the depositors, or even a quarter of the depositors of Deutsche Bank, decided to withdraw their funds on the same day, Deutsche Bank would be out of business instantaneously. We did a study at Monocle where we took the Banker magazine publishes a list every July of the top 1,000 banks in the world. And the financial crisis hit in 2007 and 2008. So we decided to look at the list of the top 1,000 banks in the world in 2006, and then look into 2010, what the outcome of those banks were. And 106 of those banks no longer existed. So that would be 106 divided into 1,000, which is a 10% default frequency, which is insane. Even in the industry of aerospace, or for example, gold mining, or for example, sulfate mining, you don't have that kind of default frequency. And that's been true throughout history. In South Africa alone, in 2002 and 2003, 22 out of 45 banks failed. That was half of the banking system. Failed. So this has been a persistent theme throughout history. And that's why I call it a fairy tale, that banking is safe.
And I don't want to leave everybody with this fear that they aren't going to take their bank, their money out the banks today. Because I think what I would like to do, David, is come to what can we do about the system, or, you know, how do we protect ourselves if these are, this is money that we're putting in a deposit? Is cryptocurrency the answer? Because I know what your answer to that is. But before I go there, I wanted to deal with, bring something a little bit closer to home, because, you know, we started off by saying there's this cognitive dissonance between, like, oh, we don't trust banks, we put our money there, right? But there is this general belief that the financial system is rigged against the average person. And I think you know, your conclusions about the Federal Reserve probably, which we'll get to, will confirm that feeling a little bit, that it's rigged against the average person. There's this wealthy elite that's in control, or at least the system is built to benefit this elite at the expense of the average person. So we had this massive crisis, I want to use, or I don't know how to do it, but we started believing, there was this conversation, it's still going on, that the South African rand would be so much stronger if it wasn't for the big South African banks. I think specifically there, people this was the narrative, had been devaluing the currency over years. And I even heard a quasi-economist saying the rand would be 8 rand to the dollar if it wasn't for these evil banks. And I was shocked by this narrative, because I started to realize how much mistrust there was out there. And because of this mistrust, how easy it was for this misinformation to spread. And I want to unpack a little bit, you know, how much of this kind of evil bank narrative is true and how much is conspiracy, and how do we know which is which?
It's a really great question. So there is a general belief that the financial system is rigged, and that it's rigged on a kind of massive kind of RICO style rigged basis. And that simply is not true. There are many, many regulators in the way of that happening. And the South African regulator of banks, which is the SARB, is actually a very strong institution. People might not like to hear me say that, but it is a fact. We have very strong banking regulations in South Africa. The system is not rigged. There are, however, bad actors. And there are persistently bad actors in the financial system that have been rewarded, you might say, by a culture of greed. And that was certainly true in the 1990s, especially kind of the Wall Street icon of, you know, these greedy bankers fleecing the public. Now, what happened with the Rand manipulation saga, and it's not the first time the Rand has been manipulated. It was manipulated in 2000 as well. I was on a trading floor when it occurred. Is that if a group of traders at different banks get together in a particular moment in time, and they're able to position to take certain positions in the market using derivative trades, and they reward each other with under the table kind of rewards, and sometimes very trivial rewards like who's going to pay for lunch? And I'm not joking, at a fancy restaurant, that could be the reward on a kind of billion rand or 10 billion rand trade. Usually not that big, but say a 500 million rand trade. And that will impact the value of the rand to the dollar and other currencies momentarily until the market corrects itself. Once these people have benefited from this small difference in the rand value, they will leave it alone and they'll come back to do it another day. This is a movement up or down that suits them in a moment in time. But the market itself is very liquid and they can't sustain it, and nor do they wish to sustain it. So for that, they were found guilty and, you know, they were prosecuted. In the US, and South Africa then decided to conduct its own investigation and came to a much stronger conclusion that a group of banks had worked together in an anti-competitive way to manipulate the rand over a sustained period of time. There is no sufficient evidence for this. They've been found not guilty. In fact, a judge won't even hear the case because there's not sufficient evidence. A public statement has been made by various banks, and there's simply no evidence to support this, and nor is it true. I can tell you, as an industry person who's been in banking for, you know, the better part of 25 years, there is rand manipulation. It is not the reason that the rand has consistently been devalued against the dollar. The reason for that is that we have a very poor economy. It's been very badly managed, and government is finding it very, or the ruling party is finding it very opportunistic to blame this very vague story of rand manipulation by some New York traders on the state of the economy, whereas we can just point to Eskom and Transnet and all kinds of cadre deployment as being the real reasons. So it's sad that government would blame banking when banking is in fact the lifeblood. I mean, in fact, banks in South Africa are lending tremendously to government. If it weren't for the banks in South Africa lending to government, we'd be in a much more dire situation in this country. So it's very disingenuous, very opportunistic. It's illustrative of the kind of world that we live in. And it's not only true in South Africa, it's true also in Argentina and other countries.
You know, what was so interesting for me was reading why banks fail. In your book, you relate a story in the US of when President Nixon, so there was this massive currency shock in the US. And in August 1971, Nixon said, "We must create more and better jobs. We must stop the rise of the cost of living. We must protect the dollar from the attacks of international money speculators." But of course, as you explained in the book, the problem was not international money speculators. The problem was the US economy. So this is what governments do when their economy is imploding. They've made some really big and bad decisions. They blame this kind of speculators, because nobody really understands, the average person on the ground doesn't really understand how the stuff works. So it's this easy kind of scapegoat, isn't it? And I just thought that Nixon's comments were almost like cut and paste for us. Your currency is weak. People are asking questions. So you say, it's those evil bankers. It's the evil speculators. It's not us. So very similar.
Nixon was a bad guy. I mean, the war in Vietnam had cost America an arm and a leg. Really, 50,000 U.S. soldiers had lost their lives. The U.S. had completely spent more money than it had in reserve in gold. The president of France was not happy with this. He said, "No, you got to give us gold, not U.S. dollars," because the U.S. was borrowing heavily. Nixon couldn't do it because they didn't have the gold to pay France back, and he simply blamed the speculators, which was really disingenuous and a lie. And I mean, I would say there's a high correlation between the myth of the Illuminati, or the myth of, you know, these somehow this network of evil that are really in control of the world, which is often used in times of crisis, economic crisis, like the Blackstone people and these money speculators, these vague references to these other people who really run the world. And in fact, government has simply failed to do its job.
It's just that easy scapegoat. And I think it is important just to sum up, yes, there is currency manipulation. There's LIBOR manipulation. We had that, 2006 to 2010. But again, these are bad actors, and these are very small, tiny little trades in a specific moment, but it's not long-term, conspiracy against the currency, because you actually, as you said, you can't, the forces, the market forces wouldn't allow that. There would be arbitrage, there would be closing up those gaps, people would see it quickly. So in some ways, the market itself, just the massive liquidity of the South African currency, which it is one of the most liquid emerging market currencies in the world, it's really difficult to do. So I think it's just important to place that. We're not saying that people don't manipulate currencies, because everyone refers you back to 2001 and the what's it, Kevin Wakeford, you know, story, and you agree there was manipulation, but it doesn't last for very long. It kind of gets shut down, and, you know, bad actors. But I want to go to this idea of bad actors, because I love, there was a story in your book about the collapse of the Stockholm Bank in 1668. The bank manager was sentenced to death for his mismanagement of the bank. I think eventually you said it was commuted to a prison sentence. But then you talk about Nick Leeson. Those of us, anyone listening who's old enough will remember, he brought down Barings Bank. He served 4 years in prison, went on to write a bestseller, made it into a movie, and went on to be a TV celebrity. And the global financial crisis triggered by Dick Fuld, who was CEO of Lehman Brothers, who used an accounting gimmick called Repo 105. And as you pointed out, not illegal, but it brought down a bank and triggered a global crisis. Mm. He has never been convicted. And you write that individual bad actors are often publicly shamed, but are rarely held accountable. But you also point out that when a bad actor is singled out and blame for malfeasance, this disguises the incentives that are embedded in the system. So are we talking about bad actors, or is it a bad system?
You know, Maya, I think it was a bad system prior to 2008. There was a difference between an investment bank and a bank. So, for example, Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, those were investment banks, and they were not held to the same rules that banks were. Following the global financial crisis, which I cannot overstate to you how severe that crisis was, to the extent that the Fed has subsequently printed 10 times more money, so there are literally 10 times more dollars in circulation in the world, in computers, I'm not talking about physical paper, talking about real dollars, than there was prior to the crisis. Since then, they've put in place rules that have forced these investment banks to be treated as banks. So they have to meet the same obligations, which goes back to the rules that were first put in place in the 1930s after the stock market crash of 1929. There are still bad incentives in place, and there are still places where regulators could probably close some loops. But trading as a practice has been made much safer and much more clean. And most of the bad actors have moved out of banking into hedge funds. So you still find the bad actors, but you'll find them more in hedge funds, which are less regulated, and you'll find them in crypto, which is your Sam Bankman-Frieds, and you'll find them in the less regulated markets. So those bad actors kind of move between industries or between sub-industries. But banking, as we understand it, which is to say commercial banking, retail banking, and investment banking, is highly, highly regulated. Where it's less regulated than I would like is in America. So there was a pullback in 2018 under the Trump administration of the Dodd-Frank Act, which was put in place post the financial crisis. And it was because of that pullback, and as a direct result of that, as well as the actions of the Fed, that we had three of the largest four bank failures in America in 2023. I would say, if anything, banking is to some extent overregulated. You've read the conclusion of my book, and I don't want to give it away in this discussion, but in the conclusion, I make some very strong recommendations, is actually to take some of the regulations away. But banking as a system of incentives is far less prone to incentivize bad actors than it was pre-2008.
I think, I mean, that's an important point, and hopefully we'll all feel a little bit better about that. But I, you know, you mentioned a little bit of some of your conclusions, and one of the points that, you know, as I said, David, I was highlighting the book a lot, but this I really like double highlighted, because you write in here that what most people can't articulate is exactly what they've lost faith in. And you argue that the answer is that they've lost faith in the guardian of the world's reserve currency, which is the dollar. So, in other words, they've lost faith in the Federal Reserve. And you put this erosion of trust, this whole feeling like that the system is wrong, that there's this rise of cryptocurrency, all of these things at the doorstep of the Federal Reserve. And you write that rather than acting in the interests of the American population as a whole, the Fed has shown itself to be strongly preoccupied with the opinions of an elite group of traders, a few hundred people around the world who control the bond markets, specifically trading US debt. So again, is this true that the system favors a few? I mean, what should we be doing about this? And maybe also bring in some of your recommendations to improve the banking system.
So yes, Maya, I mean, I guess in writing these books, and in speaking on platforms and in being asked these questions and in being in debates with crypto acolytes, I've been forced to modify my kind of general knowledge and general sense of trying to alert the public about the problems to actually being more precise. And unfortunately, I can be more precise, and I can say that it is Janet Yellen and it is Jerome Powell that I can blame. And it is, I can argue this with great confidence, because America's got an asset which no other country has, which is that once it got off the gold standard because of Richard Nixon, the dollar became the de facto currency for backing transactions. So we moved to a fiat currency backed world. And it's a great advantage to have the fiat currency as your currency. And then you have to understand that the central bank of America, which is the Federal Reserve, cannot be politicized. So it marks its own homework. There's no regulator for the regulator. So the Federal Reserve is in charge of the currency and in charge of the banking system. When the financial crisis occurs, which was also the Fed's fault because they didn't stop the buildup of credit, which they should have, to unlock the interbank market, which had seized, they simply printed money in a process called quantitative easing and held interest rates super low for over a decade, until inevitably inflation occurred. They blame inflation on the war in Ukraine, but that's not true. There's a lot of evidence that inflation had started before that. And so there are many points in time in the last decade and a half where they had the opportunity to act and to meaningfully act, and they chose not to out of fear that they would upset the markets. There were several rounds of what are called the taper tantrums, where they saw that the market was freaking out. And by freaking out, I meant, and by that I mean that they were selling bonds, and selling US debt, because there was a fear in the market that the Fed was going to take away the free money. And so they stopped taking away the free money. So they pulled back on the tapering. And there's a lot of evidence, tremendous evidence, that the Fed has led us to where we are today, which is to say that when you print 10 times more money, you devalue money itself. This pretty much explains, this printing of money explains the rise of crypto. The valuation of crypto is directly related to the size of the Fed's balance sheet. One can literally get a very strong correlation between the size of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet when it creates money, it buys debt out of the market, and the NASDAQ. I mean, it's insane. In 2023, the NASDAQ went up by more than 55%. The crypto, I think, went from $19,000 or $18,000 to $40,000 in 2023. That's a lot of money. I mean, that's going from $1 trillion to $2 trillion. That's a lot of money. The GDP of America is $22, $23 trillion. So to have a doubling of the size of the crypto market, and that's a direct result of the signaling of the Fed. We ended recent, I mean, the, we are in a world in which there's currently a potential for very dire conflict in the Middle East, very dire conflict in Europe, an ongoing war, you know, Russia, Ukraine, and really, really not looking good for Taiwan. And we have a situation where there's actually been an uptick in inflation. But yet, the S&P 500 has reached last week an all-time high. So there's something wrong in the system, in my view. I don't mind that people are making money in the stock market, don't get me wrong. And I don't even mind that people are making money in the crypto market. In fact, I would like people to invest in things that make money. What I'm concerned about is that in providing those markets, the Fed has fed the market instinct and the trader instinct rather than served the people. So there's also been a rise in inequality. And there's been a fracturing, of belief, and there's been a huge loss of trust, to the extent that in the US Congress, they cannot even get funding for Ukraine to defend itself against Russia. Such is the fact, the fracturing. We will see Trump eliminate his rivals. It's incredible. He won Iowa by 30 points in the primaries. Trump, at his age, is looking to be, if there were a general vote in the US right now, I think Trump would win. So there's been a massive fracturing of belief. America is divided. And all of this relates to our belief in the system and what could be closer to home than money, money in our pockets. So I believe that I can relate, that I can draw causality between the actions of the Fed and the distrust in all institutions, not just in the financial institutions, and therefore in democracy itself. I know it's a bit of a stretch, but I'm arguing that the way that the Fed and the way that regulators overall have behaved with the world's reserve currency has accelerated the decline in democracy. Mm. That's the argument we make.
It's actually very interesting because today I got a press release from Davos and the big theme is the trust. They said the trust has broken. Mm. We're fractured, all of those things. So even at this, we have comments about Davos and thoughts about that. But the point is all the world leaders are sitting there saying, we've got a trust problem. We've got a massive trust deficit. And you're saying this started with how the Fed behaved with quantitative easing. And I think I think it was an Age of Menace. I think it was an Age of Menace where you spoke about how they literally made the billionaires. I mean, the Elon Musks of this world, the Jeff Bezos, were created by quantitative easing. That's why they're there. And I think you made the point. They're not that genius. They are, you know, they're clever people, but they're not, the value quantum isn't there, right? They are zillionaires simply because there was all this money to invest and there was all this extra money. And I think those, so again, to the listeners, I really, if you're wanting to really understand the stuff, you want to educate yourself, I found these books really, really helpful in doing so. But I do feel like we need to do another whole session on cryptocurrencies. I don't want to go there now because I know you've got lots of views on that. And a lot of people have, and that's talking about another divisive thing, cryptocurrency. So maybe we set something up for there. But I want to put some conclusions down. You know, we spoke about the inherent unsafety of banks. They are riskier. What do you think are the solutions we need to put in place?
So first of all, just to your audience, please, can I send the message that you can trust the banks in South Africa? The South African Reserve Bank is a very good institution and it's independent of government. These are facts. And that is true in most of the world, but not all of the world. Secondly, I think it's worth sending the message that we live in a safer world than the one that we lived in 2001, because we have to, in the banking system, we identify bad actors such as terrorists and money launderers. And that's why we have a lot of regulation around the identity of bank accounts. I definitely believe that the single easiest thing to fix that could be fixed immediately is the capital ratio. So the capital ratio is the amount of money that a bank has to set aside when it creates loans. And the capital ratio is way too high. It's not the solution. You will still have bank failures, no matter whether it's high or low. But in having it held so high, you actually are having such a drag effect on banking that it's an unattractive industry to invest in, which leads investments in banks to come from countries that are totalitarian regimes, such as Qatar or Saudi. So we don't want those to be the last resort investors, such as what happened with Credit Suisse. We want investors to be long-term investors from liberal democracies. So to lower the capital ratio would make banking returns more attractive, would make investment landscape broader and more attractive, and it would empower liberal democracies to have more control over their own banking systems. That would be the number one thing that could occur or change that could be made, and that could be made by the Basel Committee for Banking Supervision. And it would be a big step for them because it would be completely...
Against all the regulation they recently put in, yes.
It's completely opposite to what's just, we're on Basel IV at the moment. And don't get me wrong, Maya, we're helping banks implement Basel IV. So, but I'm talking about a massive rethink. I also think that the LCR and NSFRs, that's the liquidity coverage ratio and net stable funding ratio, are good observing regulations, but are not quite in line with the banking model. The model that worked best for banking in the past. So I think that could be looked at. And I would absolutely say that we need to have some more prosecutions of individual bad actors. And that, again, if we were in the US, I would say you could set up a fast track, attorney general. In South Africa, we have a more fundamental problem is we're having trouble prosecuting people at all. You know, the National Prosecuting Authority is not being successful at getting hold of the Guptas and not being successful at prosecuting ESCOM executives. So that is what has led to our grey listing, by the way. One of the two factors that has led to our grey listing. So we need in South Africa to make people accountable, something that we failed at in general, which is to prosecute bad actors. Mm-hmm. I believe that there is a way that this could be done if business rose up together and demanded it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure to which audience or to whose ears they would demand it, but I do believe if there were enough of us demanding it, it would make mm-hmm. some sense.
Great. Well, thank you, David. And I think it is important to sum up that, yes, what you talk about, banks are inherently risky. The point, though, is that certainly the large South African banks, well-regulated, well-run, you don't need to run out and take your money out of there. South Africa actually does. I think we are one of the most stable banking. We've been rated endlessly, always, I think, in the top five or thereabout. So good thing to know. Very good thing to know. So not about racing off and taking your money out the bank. But I think it is, we're raising, I think for me, David, what we've done in this podcast is when the people have sat with that discontent in themselves and they're sitting there thinking, why does this not make sense? Why am I feeling like there's there's something else going on here. I think we've covered that. We've spoken about what is actually going on and some of these challenges. And also, you know, be careful of allowing those feelings to become conspiracy theories. I'm with you. I always think, you know, I read, just to sum up, I was reading your book and I was reading a more conspiracy theory based version of just as quickly, I don't want to take up too much time on the podcast, but in 1933, when the US they said to Americans they couldn't hold on to their gold, they needed to deposit it because they had to issue currency against it. You know, you explained it as, you know, why this happened and all the rest. And the other one was, of course, this was a long-term plan to take ownership of everything of the world, part of this great global players who've been here for centuries and trying to take ownership of everything. So it's sometimes the same event, you just put different motives behind it. And I think one must be sometimes careful. I'm a little bit with Occam's razor. I don't think humans are quite that organized over extended periods of time. Maybe over short terms, they can take each other out for lunch and manipulate the currency. But I don't think we cooperate sufficiently for long-term conspiracy to last.
Precisely. we're not organized enough to be to be the Illuminati. Yeah.
Anyway, David, thank you again so much for your time. And definitely, there's definitely a follow-up in this. Thank you.
Thank you, Maya.